Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI.
Welcome to this deep dive. Today we're getting into a real classic of Victorian suspense, Wilkie Collins' incredible novel, The Woman in White.
Oh, it's a giant. And when it came out around 1860, it wasn't just popular, it was, well, a sensation, literally.
Right. Collins, he knew Charles Dickens really well. They were great friends, but Collins sort of carved out his own niche with this sensation novel thing.
He absolutely did. These books, they peeled back the wallpaper on respectable Victorian homes, showed you the secrets, the crime, the sort of psychological darkness underneath.
And people couldn't get enough. I read they used to queue up for the magazines, just desperate for the next installment. That serial format really demanded suspense, didn't it? Constant cliffhangers.
Totally. Collins was a master at it. And what we really want to unpack today is the core of that suspense, this really diabolical plot. It's all tangled up with Victorian law, specifically how frighteningly a woman's whole identity could just be erased.
Yeah, legally erased. It's chilling.
And Collins kicks it all off with maybe one of the most famous opening scenes ever. You've got Walter Hartwright. He's a young drawing teacher.
Just an ordinary guy, really.
Exactly. And he's walking late at night, lonely road near London. And suddenly, there she is.
The woman in white. Anne Catherick. Just appears, dressed all in white, clearly distressed. It's pure Gothic right from the start.
It really is. And she gives him these vague but really disturbing warnings, especially about a certain Sir Percival Glyde. Then she just melts away into the night.
Leaves Walter completely unnerved. But he's got this job offer up north at Limeridge House.
Right, which seems like this perfect, peaceful country estate. He's going there to teach drawing to two half-sisters.
Laura Fairley, who's beautiful, gentle, the heiress, and who looks unnervingly like that woman in white he just met.
The resemblance is key. And then there's her half-sister, Marion Helcombe, who is, well, she's something else entirely, incredibly sharp.
So the stage is set, but then, uh-oh, Walter falls for Laura, hard.
Of course he does, but it's doomed from the start. Classic Victorian style. Duty calls. Laura's already engaged.
And guess who too?
Yep. The very man Anne Catherick warned him about Sir Percival Glyde, whom Laura's never even met. It's all there. The trapped heroine, the earnest hero who can't help, and the shadow of danger creeping closer.
Okay, let's pause on the story for a second and talk about how Collins tells it. Because this isn't just a great plot. The structure itself was revolutionary. It's basically a forerunner to the modern mystery novel.
Absolutely. His big innovation, I think, is how he plays with perspective, how he controls what you, the reader, know and when you know it.
He ditches the typical all-knowing narrator, right?
Yeah.
The one who usually tells you what's really going on.
Completely. Instead, he uses what he calls witness testimonies. It's brilliant. The whole novel is built from different characters' written accounts.
So you get Walter's narrative, then Marion Helcombe keeps this incredibly detailed diary.
You even get letters, legal documents, statements from doctors, sometimes even bits from the villains themselves. It's like Collins is handing you a case file.
And you, the listener or the reader, you're essentially the jury, trying to sift through these different viewpoints, figure out who's reliable, what the truth actually is.
It was a really bold move. He's basically saying truth isn't simple. It's pieced together. It depends who's talking. And that's vital because the villains are experts at manipulating the official story, the documents.
So if the paper trail can be faked,
then you have to rely on human testimony, on piecing together those subjective accounts. It fits the theme perfectly. Who gets to control the narrative? Who defines reality?
Which brings us right back to the characters, especially the women. What's Collins really saying here about women's power or lack of it in that society?
Well, you've got Laura Fairley first. She's almost the archetype of the Victorian ideal woman. Beautiful, gentle, dutiful, maybe a bit passive.
She's been raised to obey, hasn't she? Even when her instincts scream otherwise.
Exactly. Which makes her tragically vulnerable. She embodies how that whole system could make a woman the perfect victim, almost weaponizing her supposed delicacy against her.
But then, Marion Helcombe.
Wow. Marion is the game changer. She's arguably the real hero of the book. Collins goes out of his way to say she's not conventionally beautiful, calls her ugly by Victorian standards.
Which was a statement in itself back then.
Huge. But she has this incredible mind, like almost coded as masculine intelligence in the book, fiercely loyal, unbelievably resourceful, and tough as nails.
She sees through the BS. She's the protector, the strategist.
Completely. She represents this intellectual and emotional force that just refuses to fit into the box society built for women. It's her brain, not her looks, that keeps the fight going. She's unforgettable.
Okay, so against Marion and Laura, we have the villains,
yeah.
A duo. Sir Percival Glyde is the one driving the immediate action, isn't he?
Yeah, Glyde's the brute force, you could say. He's desperate for Laura's money. Her inheritance is massive, £20,000, which he needs badly for his debts.
But it's more than just debt, right? There's a deeper secret.
Oh, yeah. The real terror driving him is that his title, his whole identity as Sir Percival, is a complete fraud. He's illegitimate. If that gets out, he loses everything. So he needs the money, yes, but he also needs Laura, quiet. Controlled. He's prone to these fits of rage, real panic violence.
And then there's the puppet master, Count Fosco.
Ah, Fosco, one of literature's greatest villains. He's physically huge, incredibly charming, always polite, and completely amoral, utterly ruthless. He's the brains of the operation.
Collins gives him these weirdly specific quirks, doesn't he? The pet birds, the white mice.
Loves his little pets.
Mm-hmm.
And always eating sweet pastries, tarts. It's chilling because it shows this detachment. He can pour affection onto these small, controllable creatures, but has zero empathy for humans.
So his motivation isn't just money either.
No, I mean, the money's useful, but for Fosco, it feels like it's more about the intellectual puzzle, the thrill of pulling off this incredibly complex, perfectly executed crime. He admires intelligence, even in his enemies.
So the plot ramps up. Walter, heartbroken, takes off for an expedition in Central America, gets him out of the way.
Conveniently, yes. And Laura, feeling bound by duty and her father's dying wish, marries Sir Percival. They move to his oppressive estate, Blackwater Park, and it becomes a living nightmare.
But Marion goes with her, thank goodness.
Marion is Laura's lifeline. Her diary from this period is just gripping. She's watching Glyde, watching Fosco, who arrives as a guest, sensing the danger closing in, trying desperately to protect Laura. She records everything.
Which leads to that scene.
Yeah.
The one everyone remembers, Marion on the roof.
Iconic. It's pouring rain, thunderstorm raging. Marion literally climbs out onto this slippery veranda roof, risking her life just so she can eavesdrop on Fosco and Glyde, finalizing their plan below.
Incredible bravery, but it costs her.
Terribly. She gets soaked, catches a fever, collapses, completely incapacitated. And that's the villain's chance. While Marion, the only one sharp enough to stop them, is helpless. They strike.
They use Anne Catherick's death, right? The original woman in white.
Exactly. Anne, who we learn had a serious heart defect, dies naturally. And because she looks so much like Laura.
Yeah, they see their opportunity.
Their masterstroke. They arrange for Anne Catherick to be buried, but under Laura's name, forged death certificate, the works.
And the real Laura.
The real Laura, heavily drugged, confused, possibly traumatized into silence, is secretly committed to a private insane asylum.
Under Anne Catherick's name.
Precisely. Claiming she's this poor, mad woman who thinks she's Lady Glyde. It's horrifyingly clever.
So let's just sit with that. Thematically, this is the absolute core, isn't it? Laura is alive, but for all legal intents and purposes, she ceases to exist.
Completely erased. And the novel just lays bare how easily it could be done, especially to a woman. All it took was a couple of pieces of paper, a fake death certificate, a doctor's signature on commitment papers, often influenced by the husband. Her actual living self became irrelevant against the official record.
The very system meant to provide order and identity becomes the tool used to destroy her.
That's the chilling critique. Victorian law, property rights, medical authority, they all conspired in this scenario against the vulnerable individual, especially if she was female and inconvenient to a powerful man. Her identity was basically controlled by others.
Which makes Walter Hartwright's return so crucial. He comes back from Central America, finds out Laura is supposedly dead, but then discovers her alive, but registered as Anne Catherick, traumatized, barely recognizable.
But he does recognize her. That love, that connection is real, but he knows instantly it's not enough. The law says she's Anne Catherick, an imposter.
So he has to change. He can't just be the romantic artist anymore.
No, he becomes this relentless investigator, an amateur detective driven by love, yes, but also by this fierce need for justice. His whole mission shifts to reclaiming her legal identity, proving the conspiracy. It's all about, as Collins puts it, what a man's resolution can achieve.
He realizes he can't just go to the police. They'd trust the documents. He has to find the flaw in the villain's plan. He has to go after Glyde's secret.
Right. He follows the clues, digs into Glyde's past, which eventually leads him to this little church in Old Wilmingham, to the parish register.
And he finds it. The proof. The tampered marriage register that shows Glyde's parents weren't legally married before he was born. He's illegitimate. The title is fake.
That's the leverage he needs against Glyde. But Glyde finds out Walter knows. In a panic, he races back to the church vestry to destroy the register.
And gets trapped.
Locks himself in, accidentally starts a fire trying to burn the evidence, and dies in the flames. It's incredibly dramatic, very poetic justice, consumed by the secret he tried to hide.
So one villain down, but the big fish, the mastermind, Fosco, is still out there. And he holds the final key, doesn't he?
Absolutely. Fosco knows everything. Only a full confession from him can definitively prove Laura's identity and clear her name legally. Glyde's death doesn't solve that.
So Walter has to track down Fosco in London. But how do you take on someone like Fosco? He's too smart for brute force or ordinary legal challenges.
Walter knows he needs something extraordinary. Leverage that hits Fosco where he lives, outside the reach of English law. And Walter finds it.
Fosco has his own secret past.
A big one. Walter discovers Fosco isn't just a term in count. He's a fugitive, a spy who betrayed a secret Italian political society, the Brotherhood, a very dangerous group to cross.
So it's basically blackmail, but on a sort of grand political scale.
Exactly. Walter confronts Fosco, not with threats of the police, but with the threat of exposing him to the Brotherhood. And Fosco, in this weird way, almost admires Walter's ruthlessness. He sees a worthy opponent.
He respects the game.
He does, so he agrees. In exchange for Walter arranging safe passage for him out of England, guaranteed silence towards the Brotherhood, Fosco sits down and writes it all out.
Full confession. Naming names, dates, how they drugged Laura, swapped the identities, everything.
Meticulously detailed. It's the document that finally, legally proves Laura is Laura. It restores her identity, her fortune, her life.
And Fosco. Does he just get away?
He gets his safe passage out of England, but Collins gives him a final fitting end. We learn later he was found dead in Paris, assassinated, presumably by an agent of that same Brotherhood he betrayed years ago. His past caught up with him, just not via the English justice system.
Wow. So when you look back at the whole thing, the message is pretty stark, isn't it? Justice wasn't found in the system.
Not at all. It was achieved despite the system, through sheer grit, detective work, personal loyalty, and, well, blackmail. The official channels were part of the problem.
And that theme of appearance versus reality just runs through everything. The respectable Sir Percival's a fraud. The charming Count Fosco is a monster. The quiet country house hides a conspiracy.
And sometimes the weakest characters, like Laura, endure unimaginable suffering, while the unconventional ones, like Marion, possess the greatest strength. You can't judge by surfaces.
So in the end, Laura gets her name back. She marries Walter. Inherits Limeridge after her uncle dies. Their son becomes the heir. Loyalty and persistence win out.
They do. It's a victory hard won through personal integrity against institutional failings. But Marion Halcombe, she's the one who really stays with you, I think. That intelligent, resilient woman operating outside the narrow confines of what Victorian society expected.
The deep dive shows us that Wilkie Collins didn't just write a thrilling mystery. He penned a powerful social indictment that remains chillingly relevant today, demonstrating that truth must always be fought for.
Indeed, the story endures because it reminds us that loyalty and critical thinking are the strongest weapons against sophisticated deception, especially when the law itself can be turned against you. Mandatory closing line. This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.